From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the December 2022 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Top Secret Misinformation, Part 3. It's that time of the year again when all the members of the podcast team get together in the same room. And to explain why we're all in the same room, who better than Erica Munro, Bletchley Park's Exhibitions Manager and your podcast host?
Thank you, Mark. Since the first two Top Secret Misinformation podcasts that we did in 2020 and 2021, our listeners have been asking us to record one more. Maybe it's because the secrecy surrounding Bletchley Park is the perfect breeding ground for all sorts of myths and misunderstandings. Or maybe it's just because it lets our historians off the leash to set the record straight once and for all. We asked our listeners, as we did before, via social media, what history mysteries they wanted solved by our resident representatives of research and rigour. And they are Dr. David Kenyon.
Hello.
And Dr. Thomas Cheatham.
Good evening.
In this episode, they're joined by me and our podcast producer, Mark Cotton.
Hello.
To try to get to the bottom of some of Bletchley Park's most puzzling conundrums.
I think, everyone, a round of applause for Erica's introduction, please.
I pat myself too.
With Pete.
Yeah, no one else is going to.
All downhill from here.
Before we start, I think there are a couple of perennials that have come up again that we should get out of the way really quickly. Now, who wants to take... Did Winston Churchill say the geese that laid the golden eggs?
And never cackled.
And never cackled.
I have a phrase that I use on these occasions, which is, I can find no evidence that Churchill ever said this. This is not uncommon with Churchill. Churchill is accused of saying all sorts of things which he never said. There's a lot of things he did say. There's a lot of things he never said. And unfortunately, this is one of the ones that, if you start looking for references to it in all of the relevant literature, it just doesn't come up. It's in a lot of Bletchley Park books, but they all just reference each other. So, and there's also the fact that the story of Bletchley Park was still secret when Churchill died. So
yeah,
he's unlikely to have made any public pronouncements about GC&CS because it was a secret.
Correct. And the other one, I think, Tom, you can answer this one for us, which kind of links to Churchill because there's a rumour about a tunnel from the station that was only used by Churchill. But are there tunnels at Bletchley Park?
There are no tunnels of that type at Bletchley Park. There are no secret access tunnels, secret tunnels from the station, secret back entrances to allow Churchill or any other visiting dignitaries inside the wire. There are a couple of tunnels, technically tunnels, which carry conveyor belts in a couple of places. And those are important for getting messages to and fro, but I don't think that's what people are normally talking about.
No, and you've covered this in a previous answer, didn't you?
Yeah. The other thing is, some staff worked in rooms that were down a set of steps and didn't have any windows.
Yeah.
So they seem to have assumed they were working underground in some sort of bunker. So people sometimes describe bunkers as Bletchley, but they weren't really working in bunkers. They were just working in hardened, windowless teleprinter rooms, for example, which gave that impression.
I was going to say, since we opened our new exhibition, The Intelligence Factory, which is entered by going down a set of stairs into a darkened corridor, I've heard some of our visitors thinking that they are going underground there, so perhaps the myth will prevail.
It probably will. So this time next year, when we do part four of these, we'll answer the same two questions again, no doubt. So, Erica, let's get on to some more substantial questions that we can get some more substantial answers for.
We've had a fair few sent to us, and we've picked the most interesting for our listeners. And I would like to kick off with one directed to Tom. We've been asked, were people at Bletchley Park really recruited by crossword puzzle?
This is a really, really old one that comes up in all sorts of places. The answer is technically yes, but only about six people on one occasion. And it's not because it was planned by anyone at Bletchley Park. So the story here, it comes from a veteran called Stanley Sedgwick. As he tells the story, he was a fan of the Telegraph crossword. And at one point in the war, there was some correspondence in the letters pages of the newspaper about the crossword. And this all led to a Mr. Gavin, he tells us, chairman of the Eccentrics Club.
Oh, I love the sound of the Eccentrics Club.
Who wrote in saying he would donate £100 to the Minesweepers Fund if it could be demonstrated under controlled conditions that anyone could solve the Daily Telegraph puzzle in less than 12 minutes. So then they organised this competition at the Daily Telegraph offices on Fleet Street, and Stanley Sedgwick goes along with about 30 other people to try this out. About five people succeeded in solving the crossword under 12 minutes, and Sedgwick, in fact, narrowly missed out because he had one clue left when the bell went. And then he says, we were then given tea in the chairman's dining room and dispersed with the memory of a pleasant way of spending a Saturday afternoon. Imagine my surprise when several weeks later I received a letter marked confidential, inviting me, as a consequence of taking part in the Daily Telegraph crossword time test, to make an appointment to see Colonel Nichols of the General Staff. The Colonel Nichols in question, he was actually the head of MI8, which is the Army's Signals Intelligence Department, and works very closely with Bletchley Park, but is separate. So it was actually the Army, not the Government Code and Cipher School, not the civilians at all, who caught wind of the Telegraph crossword challenge and decided it might be a good way to find some suitable recruits who might have the sort of mindset they'd need for code breaking. So Sedgwick's offered this job and accepts, and then he's sent to what's called the Inter-Service Special Intelligence School, ISSIS, in Bedford, which one part of it was the Bedford Japanese School, the most famous part, but they also did lots of general training in cryptanalysis for the Army, and send people off to the Army or send them down the road to Bletchley. And after this, Sedgwick's recruited as a civilian to work in the Met section of Bletchley Park doing those weather ciphers. So along with him, there's about, as I say, five other people who were recruited by this method, according to his story, it seems.
I have a question for you. Is one of them, as would appear in the film The Imitation Game, Joan Clark?
One of them is not Joan Clark.
Thanks for clearing that up.
So it seems all of this was a one-off event. The Telegraph held this competition and somebody at MIA caught wind of it and decided, here are some people who might be suitable. It's not impossible that GCNCS orchestrated the whole thing from start to finish, but it seems a lot of effort to find six members of staff when they were bringing in hundreds of people. And there's no evidence it happened more than once. And if it was a good way of recruiting people, you would expect them to repeat the exercise. So you have this story of Bletchley Park or the Army taking advantage of this serendipitous opportunity to recruit a few people. And that means it's correct to say some people were recruited as a result of a crossword competition, but that morphs into Bletchley Park ran a crossword competition to recruit people. And then lots of people were recruited to Bletchley via crossword competitions, and it all gets a bit silly. What we've actually seen, and I've talked about this, I think, in the first Top Secret Misinformation episode we did, was that Bletchley had to discourage the association with crosswords. And they had to tell recruiters at certain points in the war, please stop sending us people just because they're slightly socially awkward and they like crosswords. Because it can be a really good indicator that somebody's got the right mindset, but also you need a more balanced skill set than just liking puzzles if you're going to really excel at this place. And of course, there's lots of jobs here in intelligence and things like indexing, which require completely different skills than you might expect from a cryptanalyst who's good at solving crosswords.
It might not surprise you that a couple of the historians in the room are quite interested in crosswords, and I have managed to locate a few of the clues from the 1942 crossword that we have just been speaking about. So if our listeners are interested, I can certainly let you know a couple of those. And what's interesting is they're not all cryptic that we would recognise. That's right, isn't it, Tom?
Yes, it's because in the 40s, I mean, cryptic crosswords, as we understand them now, were not really as formalised as they are now. So the rules weren't as strictly laid down, and you had this mix of cryptic and non-cryptic clues, and sometimes, you know, they didn't always stick to the rule that the definition has to be at the start or end of the clue, for example. So they're a bit tricky, actually, to break compared to modern cryptics.
So I'll throw 15 across, a three-letter word, which is, we have nothing and are in debt. And one other, which is an eight-letter word, which means scented, as in S-C-E-N-T-E-D. I shall leave that with our listeners to ponder over.
Are you going to give the answers at the end of the episode?
I shall, if you behave well.
Well, while we give Thomas time to think up the answers to those two.
To look at the answers.
I think it's time that the elder statesman of the historians took a front seat.
Takes a challenge. Absolutely.
Wake him up. David. Woo, wake up.
I'm not dead.
Our question has been sent in, which is directed to you. Were staff allowed to play music in the background to break up the monotony of the work at Bletchley Park?
Yes.
Great answer. Let's move on.
We can't afford to play any music underneath this, so.
Tell us more, please.
There is more, yes. Interestingly, there are memos about this in some of the correspondence connected to Bletchley. There's a file at the National Archives on welfare matters that came up from time to time, and there's files about there about sickness rates and one thing or another. But there's an interesting exchange about the staff in Block E, the communication section, and as Tom will vouch, people weren't always very happy in the communication section.
I like to say Block E, and particularly the Cypher office in Block E, was the worst place to work at Bletchley Park. I mean, I don't like to say that. I mean, I like to use
it's
the
true.
Line.
You'd rather
it's
they
true
were happy.
To say that. I'd rather they were happy and had a brilliant war.
Historians believe that Block E was.
Yes.
Anyway, Captain Melrose of the Royal Army Medical Corps. Are you familiar with Captain Melrose? Does he crop
I've come across him? Captain Melrose a couple of times.
He seems to have some responsibility for people's welfare at Bletchley. He mentions in a memo that in order to cheer the people up in Block E, they were allowed to listen to Music While You Work. Music While You Work was actually a radio show, a daytime programme on the BBC that went out twice a day. They had one show at 10:30 in the morning and one show at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the idea was that the BBC would play music that was reasonably uplifting and had a kind of rhythm that you could work to. So if you were doing some machine minding task,
you were
or building Spitfires or whatever, this, you know, you could work along to it. I was looking into this, and what I discovered, two things that surprised me actually. Music While You Work didn't just happen during World War II, it carried on until 1967.
Hmm.
So it was a feature of British life for several decades. It started in 1940 and carried on for another 27 years. What also I found surprising was all of the music was played live.
It's a bit stressful.
So they had a studio with bands in it and they played it directly into the microphone and onto the airwaves. You'd think that it would be some bloke in a panelled office putting on gramophone records, but it wasn't that at all. It was actual bands.
That's because the BBC had a set amount of time that they would play gramophone records.
Were they only allowed to play gramophone records
for
a certain amount of time?
Yeah, they would only play gramophone records for a certain amount of time. I can't remember if it's due to the musicians' union or not, but the majority of music on the radio in the early days, the 20s and 30s and 40s on the radio, even though gramophone were very popular and records were very popular, it was still the majority of the music was live bands.
The other thing that struck me, and a sentiment I entirely endorse, was that jazz was discouraged.
Unseemly, dissolute stuff.
I can't encourage that sort of behaviour. Continue.
Apparently this was because the complicated rhythms that often occur in jazz might disturb people's working. If they were sort of working to a rhythm, you needed it like a waltz time or something like that that gave them
like
a steady sort of cycle or a rousing march or whatever. Something a bit syncopated, their lathe work would deteriorate. So,
yeah, I think someone playing 5-4 is going to put out the riveting on a Spitfire wing.
Do we know how many Spitfires were lost as a consequence of jazz?
Must have been a bad thing. Hitler didn't approve.
Jazz is wonderful to listen to through headphones at work nowadays, though. It really helps the creativity.
Speak for yourself.
I do indeed, but yeah.
But they had two shows a day. Were they an hour each?
I'm not sure how long they were, but one was at 10:30 and one was at 3. And latterly, in August 1942, they introduced a nighttime episode at 10:30 at night so that people who were on night shift could have music while they worked as well.
Overtime for the musicians.
Mm.
Presumably, yes. Whether they spent sort of the intervening periods drinking tea in the back of the BBC and went, oh, you know, time to play more not jazz.
It wouldn't have been tea.
This is the BBC Home Service.
Anyway, that's Music While You Work. The problem with Music While You Work was that the other issue in Block E was it was full of teleprinters and other machinery, and it was very hot, and there was a question about whether the ventilation was adequate for the women who were in there. And the obvious solution was to open the windows. And they had tried that, but the same memo from Captain Melrose points out that when they opened the windows, Frank Birch, who was running Naval Section in Block A just next door, basically came around and told them to shut the windows again because he didn't want his staff's lives polluted by music while they were doing his naval code breaking for him. So it was music or air, basically, was the choice.
You've got to remember, it's Walter Ettinghausen and his very highly skilled people translating naval enigma messages at breakneck pace is going on at the back of Block A, directly across from where the cipher office was.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they weren't doing anything important. Or they didn't have to concentrate.
And I haven't seen a lot of teleprinters, but they're not the quietest of machines. And if there's a load of machines running in a room, I'm guessing you're going to have the volume up a little higher than usual. So the the minute you open that window, that's a racket. Kind of makes sense.
The concept of 60 teleprinters all going at the same time, superimposed with, you know, big band 40s waltz music is, yeah, it's enough to make anyone depressed, I think. But Mr. White, who ran Rocky, was adamant that this, and I quote, helped his girls with their endeavours. The solution, a typical Bletchley Park innovation, they introduced forced ventilation fans, which allowed the air to circulate, which meant they could listen to music with the windows shut. So everyone was happy. The other occasion I came across of music in my various researches was when I was looking at the story of the bomb machines, and in particular the manufacture of the machines in Letchworth by the British Tabulating Machines Company, who actually built them. People who've seen The Imitation Game, you see Alan Turing in a brick hut.
Making his machine.
That never happened. He wasn't an engineer. He came up with a mathematical concept, as we've explained previously. And then this concept was delivered to British Tabulating Machines, who actually created the devices. And one of the things they had to do was the drums on the front of the bomb machine. There's 36 drums on a standard machine. No, 108 drums. Yeah. Three times 36.
Three times 36.
And all of those have to be wired up individually with their 26 contacts on the back. And so in the factory at Letchworth, upstairs was a long gallery room where, again, there was a gender divide. There were male engineers downstairs assembling the machines and women upstairs wiring the rotors. And it was sufficiently dull and repetitive work that they would take it in turns to choose a popular song and then they'd all sing it. And this story turns out a bit like Mr. White's Music While You Work, that it upset the neighbours. And there is, unfortunately, an anonymous oral history that I found, an account of somebody who worked in there. And he says that the men downstairs didn't like the singing and used to send their Scottish foreman, a chap called Jack Darge, up the stairs to tell them all to shut up.
I wonder why I identify him particularly as Scottish. Like, he's going to power on in there and shout loudly at them.
Maybe he just was their shoutiest bloke in the downstairs. But it obviously didn't work because he had to do this quite regularly, from what I tell. So there's both listening to the wireless and spontaneous singing.
We should do more of that, I think, at modern day Bletchley Park. Spontaneous singing to encourage us to work. I love this question. Is it true? Was anybody really threatened with a revolver when they were signing the Official Secrets Act on their first day at Bletchley Park, Tom?
Possibly. The story we hear is that people arrived at Bletchley Park and they were given a sort of security briefing. And there was a military officer with a revolver who sometimes just placed his revolver on the table and sometimes referred to the revolver and sometimes stated that if you, you know, let any of this secret out, this revolver demonstrates what will happen to you. So you get these quite dramatic stories of people being threatened, having a slightly traumatic and very impactful experience the moment they arrive at Bletchley Park. But I'm going to crib directly from our oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne, here, because he's talked to many, many veterans. And he's talked to many who mentioned the revolver, but they all seem to say they heard it happen to somebody else. And nobody can say they experienced it firsthand, with one exception that I know of, who is one of our favourite veterans, Betty Webb. And Betty describes how she had her security briefing, and the revolver was on the table in its holster, and it had just been placed there. Nobody talked about the revolver. The officer didn't pick it up and wave it around.
There was no side eye kind of
no
notice.
It was just there in the room. And whether it was just a subtle hint at the possible consequences or whether it was placed on the table because the officer just took off his holster and put it on the table, well, we'll never know. But, you know, if this was a tactic that was done, I think it's fair to say that it didn't happen most of the time. It only happened to a few people. But you can imagine how an incident like that would turn into rumour very quickly and spread around the park. And it chimes very well with the obsession with secrecy that was here during the war and then among the veterans after the war. And so you can see also that some veterans may have picked it up at a later date and decided that it quite well encapsulated their experience of keeping the secret, even though it always happened to somebody else.
So if the gun wasn't necessarily there, did they have the frighteners put on them some other way?
Yeah, as we talked about in the past, definitely scared to some extent.
They put the fear of God into them, didn't they?
Yeah.
About this particular subject.
They made them sign the Official Secrets Act. They said the penalty for breaking the Official Secrets Act is potentially execution. And so they had this briefing on arrival at BP, either in the mansion or sometimes in an interview room attached to the guard hut at the main gate. And they also, during their first week here, had a security lecture and they were given the secrecy form that which we have on display, which lays it all out in very clear terms, something to take away and read in their new billets. and really mull over. And they had to sign that and return it to show they'd understood it. So they had several different ways of getting the message across to people, and it seemed to be very effective. And people did take the security very seriously.
OUP Form Number 18. Secrecy. This may seem a simple matter. It should be. But repeated experience has proved that it is not. Even for the cleverest of us, even for the least important. Month after month, instances have occurred where workers at BP have been heard casually saying outside BP things that are dangerous. It is not enough to know that you must not hint at these things outside. It must be uppermost in your mind every hour that you talk to outsiders. Even the most trivial-seeming things matter. The enemy does not get his intelligence by great scoops, but from a whisper here, a tiny detail there. Therefore, do not talk at meals. There are the waitresses and others who may not be in the know regarding your own particular work. Do not talk in the transport. There are the drivers who should not be in the know. Do not talk travelling. Indiscretions have been overheard on Bletchley platform. They do not grow less serious further off. Do not talk in your billet. Why expect your hosts, who are not pledged to secrecy, to be more discreet than you, who are? Do not talk by your own fireside, whether here or on leave. If you are indiscreet and tell your own folks, they may see no reason why they should not do likewise. They are not in a position to know the consequences, and have received no guidance. Moreover, if one day invasion came, as it perfectly well may, Nazi brutality might stop at nothing to wring from those that you care for secrets that you would give anything, then, to have saved them from knowing. Their only safety will lie in utter ignorance of your work. Be careful, even in your hut. Cleaners and maintenance staff have ears, and are human. There is nothing to be gained by chatter but the satisfaction of idle vanity or idle curiosity. There is everything to be lost. The very existence of our work here, the lives of others, even the war itself. People will always be curious. They can always learn something from your answers, if you answer, even though you only answer yes or no. Do not suggest, as is so easy and so flattering to human vanity, that you are doing something very important and very hush-hush. Far too many people in England know that about Bletchley Park already. If ever the Germans come to know it, we may find ourselves a German target for tonight. There are drawbacks to publicity. The only way, then, is to cut the conversation short. For example, question. What are you doing now? Answer. Working for the Foreign Office, or other ministry as appropriate. Question. But what do you do? Answer. Oh, work. A gay reticence in that vein will win you far more real respect from anyone worth respecting than idle indiscretion or self-important airs of mystery. There is an English proverb none the worse for being 7 centuries old. Wicked tongue breaketh bone, though the tongue itself hath none. I hereby promise that no word of mine shall betray, however slightly, the great trust placed in me. Signed.
So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that a particularly zealous officer, maybe having a bad day, pulled out his revolver and waved it around to scare people. But we think if it did happen, it didn't happen very often. And Mark, literally just before recording this episode, rang up Betty just to check against her recollection and to check we were interpreting her book correctly.
She confirmed it, yes. And Betty's very much one for... It has to be something that happened to her or she recollects. And she's very good at making sure she doesn't, you know, include something that she's read from someone else's book. And she was quite clear in saying, yes, it was just sat on the desk. As far as she could remember, in 1941, it was common practice for an officer to be carrying a sidearm.
Three or four of us decided that we were really wasting our time doing domestic science when we really ought to be doing something towards the war effort. So we left mid-term, which must have been a bit annoying for our parents, and joined the ATS, the Auxiliary Territorial Service.
How old were you at this point?
I was just coming up to 18 and hadn't been about in the world very much, and suddenly find myself doing army training in Wrexham. After that was finished, I think because I put on my CV that I spoke German, I was sent up to London to an interview, which was actually in German. And after about half an hour or so, the intelligence officer who'd interviewed me said, right, here's a railway warrant, go to Euston and get on a train for Bletchley. Well, Bletchley at that time meant absolutely nothing to me. I didn't know where it was or what its role was in the war. However, I soon found out because the first thing I had to do after a night in the civilian billet in Bradwell, I went down to the mansion and was given the Official Secrets Act to read and sign. Now, the Official Secrets Act is a fairly formidable document, especially when you're only 18, and I was quite frightened and wondered how I was going to comply with the rules, which were that you didn't speak about anything that you read or saw or heard the whole of your time there and for 30 years afterwards. So it was rather a baptism of fire, I suppose you could call it. However, I told myself that that's how it is and that's what you must do. Keep everything to yourself.
So were you in the mansion when you signed this?
Yes, yes, in the mansion, in a little room just on the left of the entrance hall. And there sat an army officer with a gun on the table and, as I said earlier, the copy of the Official Secrets Act.
And did they give you plenty of time to read through this formidable document?
I think so, yes. I don't remember being rushed. No, I was able to quietly take it in.
And he was sat there with a gun on the table. That must have been quite intimidating.
Well, yes, it was really. But I suppose, in retrospect, that was how it was in those days. Any member of the armed forces would, the men mainly, would have a gun anyway. That's how I see it.
I mean, the question arises, why would you have your revolver on the desk? And actually, this is a simple fact. If you're going to sit at a desk in a chair, wearing a holstered revolver is just, it's just uncomfortable. It gets in the way. It snags on the armrest when you get up. So the simple thing to do would be to take it off.
I suppose naturally you would put it in a drawer, wouldn't you? But yeah. I suppose Tom could be right in, you know, it might be a very, very subtle way of, well, I'll take my revolver off, but let's just leave it on the desk because that says more than I need to say, doesn't it?
I think that plus the hot off the press information from Betty Webb has cleared that question up nicely. Our next question, and this sounds like it's probably come from somebody who has visited Bletchley Park in recent years, is about the mansion. What code-breaking activities were done upstairs to which the public are not currently able to access? Upstairs in the Bletchley Park mansion. David, can you give us more information?
There is some information about this, and it is something we are currently thinking about because the upstairs of the mansion is currently vacant and empty. It was previously used as offices, so there's nothing up there specifically to do with GC&CS. There's quite a lot of wonderful architectural features from the old Leon house. There's magnificent fireplaces and bookshelves and other detail.
There's no code-breaking materials
it's
still there.
It's empty rooms, essentially.
Yeah.
A variety of interesting things did happen up there. And like so many aspects of Bletchley Park, we know some of the information, but we don't have a complete exhaustive list of what went on in each room throughout the war. But we do know that particular things happened in certain rooms at particular times. This is slightly complicated by the fact that when English Heritage, now Historic England, did their detailed survey of the building, there seems to have been some confusion about the room numbers. And I had to look into this myself, and I went back to the room numbers which came from the original sales particulars from 1937. And once you've got the right room numbers, some of the descriptions make a lot more sense, because there was a point when it appeared that about 30 members of Italian section were all in a tiny room about the size of a cupboard.
I mean, we say it was uncomfortable to work here, but
it wasn't that uncomfortable.
It's a bit much, yeah.
So now I've got a pretty good picture of some of the activity that went on up there. And you've got kind of three bits. Imagine the front vista of the mansion with the slightly odd copper dome on your left and the front door in front of you. Mm-hmm. The big rooms above that, which were the Leon's master bedrooms, if you like, they, at least for some of the war, are senior staff offices. And we know that Travis occupied one of those bedrooms for a while and Nigel de Grey occupied another one. And each of them had sort of PAs and assistants in there as well, because they're very big rooms. They would make a palatial office for somebody. But I don't imagine that they were sitting in those rooms by themselves. They would have had their support staff kind of crammed in with them. So That front bit is senior staff. There's a bit on the north side. So on your right, as you're looking at the front of the building, if you'd gone round that right-hand end and walked up that side, there's a suite of rooms around there, which were basically servants' quarters in the Leon house. And these are the offices that we briefly inhabited when we were moving around before Block A was converted. So actually, a previous episode of...
You're right, David, because the very first one of these Q&A sessions was done in that office.
It was. It was done in my old office, room 24. And that section was, for at least some of the time, occupied by people from SIS who weren't GCNCS. Because I come back to you, Tom, there were quite a few SIS people here, certainly at the beginning of the war and possibly throughout, weren't there?
Yeah, I mean, initially the site's meant to house SIS as well as GCNCS, and it's only a bit later on that Codebreakers sort of take over. So there's always SIS people at the start of the war. They're in charge of the administration. So the famous Captain Ridley of Captain Ridley's shooting party is SIS. And a few of these people stick around throughout the war. Yeah, there's always a small contingent here.
So, yes, yeah, so those are the rooms that all three of us had our offices in for a little while before we moved over here to Block A. And the other person who's known to have been up there, just outside your office, I think, Erica, was the head of the Home Guard, or the Bletchley Park section of the Home Guard. I can't remember the chap's name now. Who was it that organised, was responsible for the defences?
Duncan Shaw.
That's the man, yes. Spends the first half of the war rather fruitlessly trying to persuade Codebreakers that they should pay attention to the physical defence of the site, none of which some of them are very interested in. But yeah, so he was up there.
What did you do in the Home Guard?
I belonged. I was went on an unarmed combat course. I was made a lance corporal, indeed. But no, I didn't. I played no real part in the Home Guard, except just as a foot soldier.
When you say unarmed combat, you mean how to disable people with your bare hands and so on?
That sort of thing, yes.
Were you any good at it?
Not particularly, no.
Were you irritated with having to be in the Home Guard?
Oh, no, no, you accepted it.
Did you enjoy it?
No.
However, the bit of the upstairs of the mansion that I would like to talk about in most detail is right at the back. These are the rooms which were originally the Leon's guest bedroom wing. And if you know the site, you would have to walk around to where the garages are, where we have the Packard and the GCO container, and then turn around and look back at the mansion from that direction, and you will see some first floor bedrooms up there. And that is where John Tiltman worked, certainly from 1941 onwards. Military section initially are downstairs in the dining room, and then they're moved to Hut 5, and there's, I can't remember if you remember, Tom, there's some quite grumpy correspondence from Tiltman, isn't there, about how he thought that getting chucked out of the dining room and into a hut so that people could have lunch was a strange priority.
Yeah, I mean, Hut 5 is actually quite a distance from the mansion, under some trees, so you can imagine, especially in the winter, in the first winter they were here, tramping back and forth in the cold, when everyone else is still in the mansion. Seemed like a bit of a downgrade.
Mm.
Anyway, by 41, he has bluffed his way back into the mansion because he's in bedrooms 1, 2, and 3. Well, he's in bedroom 1, I think.
Was John Tiltman chief cryptographer by 1941?
He becomes chief cryptographer. I don't know whether he's officially chief cryptographer that early, but he certainly that's the title he develops. I think he's de facto chief cryptographer, even if he's not being called that at that point. And what happens in April 1941 is he is asked to set up a research section. And this is where nomenclature at GCNCS gets a bit complicated, because I've talked before about the Enigma research section, which is in the cottages with Twin and Knox and Turing developing the bomb machines and Gordon Welshman. This is a separate research section that comes along later. And it was set up in April 1941 by Tiltman, but it was actually run by Jerry Morgan. And rather wonderfully, Jerry Morgan is a captain in the army, so he is Captain Morgan of rum fame.
Of rum fame.
But he sets up what gets a longer title, what becomes the Cryptographic Coordination and Records section. The purpose of this section basically is, by 1941, Bletchley Park has acquired a list of cipher systems from all sorts of different countries that haven't actually been properly attacked yet. So the idea is that they've got teams up and running, dealing with Enigma, dealing with Luftwaffe, low-level codes, dealing with diplomatic, dealing with these various things. But they have a long list of things they haven't tackled yet. So the idea is that they'll assemble a team of kind of research experts who will tackle this. And there's a meeting in April 1941 which describes the setup for this.
Most secret. Research section. First meeting of the directing subcommittee held on Tuesday the 8th of April 1941. Present, Colonel Tiltman, Chairman, Mr. Cooper, Mr. Foss, Lieutenant Dudley Smith, Secretary. Objects of the research section. The general functions and objects of the new section were discussed on broad lines and were classified as follows. A. Diagnosis and solution of unknown systems. B. Improvement of methods of solution of known systems. C. Correlation of various methods of solution employed by different sections. D. Preparation and maintenance of a continuous record of systems and methods of solution. Cryptographic staff. The subcommittee proposed that Mr. Morgan should be relieved of his duties in the military section from the 1st of May 1941, and that then he should start working on the organisation of the research section. Colonel Tiltman said that 3 or 4 of the best students from the course would be available to join Mr. Morgan in the middle of May.
That memo refers to the course, and this is what Tom was talking about earlier. This is the cryptanalytical course that some new recruits to Bletchley Park are being sent on, and in particular, because they're still recruiting from Oxbridge at this point. A lot of other people from other backgrounds are coming in as well, but Denniston's old boy network is still churning away, producing bright undergraduates from Oxbridge. And one of these is Bill Tupp, who's from Trinity Cambridge, who we've spoken about in the past, and of course is very famous for his work on Lorentz and the breaking of that system. It says, Colonel Tiltman said that 3 or 4 of the best students from the course should be available to join Mr. Morgan. And one of those best students is Bill Tupp.
So Bill Tupp was working upstairs in the mansion.
Yeah, so he starts off upstairs in the mansion. Of course, we know that Bill Tupp was in this section because he wrote a number of documents himself before he died, which described his time at the park. And he talked specifically about being in the research section. As he described it, there was Captain Jerry Morgan, head of the section, and his brother Stanley, a lieutenant. And there was Sergeant Ryland smoking his pipe. There was Daphne Bradshaw, whose husband was also at the park as an administrator. Others I remember, but I think they joined later. And of course, Tom, you'll vouch for that Bradshaw is a little bit more than just an administrator, isn't he? He's kind of the administrator, not an administrator.
Keeps Bletchley Park on the road against all the odds, yeah. Very, very important.
And Daphne Bradshaw, who worked in research section. She's Daphne Circombe, originally?
Yes. I believe she is, yeah. We have some lovely pictures of their wedding.
Yes.
Currently on display in the Intelligence Factory exhibition. And good to know that Daphne Bradshaw also had a role of her own as well as just being the wife of...
Oh yeah, she was a codebreaker. Literally a code... We often refer to them collectively as codebreakers, but she was in the research section attempting to break unbroken systems. Well, there's also that photograph of Daphne Bradshaw playing rounders. There's a regularly reproduced photograph of rounders at Bletchley Park, and there's a lady in the foreground with her back to you. Mm-hmm. That is actually Daphne Bradshaw. There are other documents describing the research section, and one of the things quite interesting is that it has quite a mix of people in it. The other person besides Tutt, who is a new recruit from the course, is Norman Cecil Sainsbury. And Sainsbury was originally from Peterhouse, Cambridge, but he was a little bit older than Tutt. He'd actually graduated in 1935. And he was assistant keeper second class in the Department of Oriental Books and Manuscripts at the British Museum. So a bit like Knox, he has a background in classics and philology and those sorts of more traditional code-breaking skills versus the mathematicians that are kicking around. He's never actually employed by GCNCS because since he's already a civil servant, because the British Museum is a government establishment, he remained on the payroll of the British Museum but was seconded to Bletchley and then subsequently went back to the British Museum, as far as I know.
So we know who was up there in the mansion. What were they doing up there?
Well, I can tell you there is a list, at least in the early days of this research section, of the variety of types of things they were working on. That starts with Hagelin machine ciphers. We've talked about Hagelin. Of course, Tutt was instrumental in the breaking of Hagelin. And I have a theory that I bang on about to anyone who listens about the similarities between Hagelin and Lorentz and how it potentially influenced his work on Lorentz. JMA is another system. Japanese military attaché. Japanese naval attaché. Floridora, which I believe is a German diplomatic system.
The main German diplomatic system. I don't think they break that in the research section, but they break it later on in London, thanks to some captured material from Iceland, I think, but it's quite a long story. So one we should tell at some point. But the point is, they don't break every problem in research. They don't.
Yes, this is something
succeed.
I was just going to come back to with you, because we talked about it earlier. Vichy diplomatic systems, Finnish codes. Finland has a bit of a weird status in World War II, because you have the Winter War, as it's called, in 1939, when the Russians try and invade Finland, a subject which has become quite newsworthy lately, because now that the Finns have joined NATO, and there's a lot of recollections of the Finnish-Russian War. Of course, when the research section is first established back in April 41, Barbarossa hasn't happened yet. The Soviet Union is still technically allied with Germany. And the Finns have had this war in 1939 with the Russians. But then you get what's called the continuation war, when after Barbarossa, the Finns join in the war again against the Soviet Union and are sort of, I don't know, you put it, Tom, quasi-allies of the Germans. But
and I like this as a piece of trivia because it's the one time in history where two democracies go to war, is Great Britain and Finland, because we declare war on the Finns. But Finland is a democracy, but it aligns itself with Nazi Germany because they are fighting the Soviets. Very much the case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
I should add that there's a trope in military history, which is almost universally true, apart from this incident, which is the test of true democracies is almost never has there been a war between two genuinely representative democracies. You need totalitarianism on one side or the other for a war to happen. And so, you know, wars between properly run nations very rarely happen. You need an utter in charge. But anyway, so Finnish codes are a factor. Hungarian codes, again, Irish diplomatic ciphers.
Irish.
Of course, the Irish are neutral. And we may like the Irish, but there was always a worry that German influence in the Republic would grow and they might start doing things that we weren't approving of. So we needed to read their traffic.
And Eamon de Valera is quite happy to play off the British against the Germans in diplomatic sense.
Exactly. Again, Polish and Czech diplomatic traffic. Czechoslovakia by this point has been completely overrun by the Germans, but they have diplomats in exile and the Polish likewise. But we want to keep an eye on them, even though they're nominally on our side. You want to read your friends' codes as well as your enemies. This is something that people are often quite surprised about Bletchley Park when I give my tours and I say, well, they always spied on the French and they spied on the US and things like this. It's because certainly diplomatically, it doesn't matter whether they're your allies or not. You still try and figure out what they're up to. And then Vatican, Spanish and Comintern traffic. Comintern being, of course, the Communist Party sort of worldwide network to turn us all into communists. But a feature of this is, I was talking about the diversity of the team. Two of the French officers who have joined Bletchley Park back in 1940, and I've talked about these before, I believe, some time ago in the podcast. Mark Vey, who is one of those men, spoke Czech and Russian in addition to native French. So he's in there working on not only Vichy systems, but also some of the Czech stuff. But I think you were saying, and he's involved with JMA as well, or JNA, but makes quite a bad job of it.
We know from an interview John Tiltman gave to the NSA in the 1970s that he handed the French cryptanalyst JMA as a problem to try and solve. And by his account, they made a bit of a hash of it and he had to take it back and start from scratch, essentially. Tiltman is one of the most impressive cryptanalysts of all time. So the fact that he thought the French weren't really up to scratch doesn't mean that they were bad.
They were still in his team. So
and they must have been useful for something because they kept them around, absolutely. But as I say, they don't get everything right. Nobody at Bletchley gets everything right.
Just to wrap up on this research section, it's clear that they moved out of the mansion, possibly into one of the huts in 1942. And certainly Bill Tutt moves on from the mansion to, he spends some time actually working in the naval section, supporting as he's sort of handing over his work on Hagelin to a sort of production team in the naval section who are going to carry on doing it once he's figured out how you should do it. So he's over there for a bit. We're not sure exactly where the research team goes later, but it's pretty clear that in the early days, it's in those bedrooms 1, 2, and 3 at the back of the mansion. And it's one of the few times when we can pin down, like Turing in the loft of Cottage 3, you can fairly firmly say that Bill Tutt began his career back in those bedrooms.
Does Tutt end up in Block F in the end?
There is a bit of a mystery around Bill Tutt because he writes about his work on Hagelin and then he writes about his first visualising Lorentz and then coming up with his system for establishing the monthly pins and all of that. But from kind of 1943 to 1945, Tutt doesn't say anything about what he did at Bletchley Park. I've struggled to find out what he did.
Did he do much with Colossus and things like the crypto side of Colossus, the code-breaking brain bit rather than machine side?
Colossus embodies some of his ideas, so he's no doubt involved in the discussions around how Colossus should be developed. But actually, the thinking that he's done about that has happened in 1942, 1943.
So it's not ongoing.
It's not ongoing.
He's not one of these people like Donald Mickey, is he, who is literally working with Colossus, experimenting, working out how you do interesting computations with this new technology, but we don't really
have any
that part of his account, do we?
But he was at Bletchley Park until the end of the war.
As far as we know. But what intrigues me about it is because after the war, he emerges in the academic world as a graph theorist. I'm not a mathematician, but my understanding is that graph theory is to do with analysing networks, isn't it, basically?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've often wondered whether he does graph theoretical work while he's at Bletchley, whether he's looking at German networks in some way, and that informs what he does after the war. But if he did, he never said so. So we will probably
never know. Purely supposition.
It's purely supposition on my part, but it's one of those interesting mysteries. How Bill Tutt got from breaking Lorentz to graph theory, because it doesn't seem like an obvious jump, but...
it's a history mystery.
There may be mathematicians out there who can send me angry emails and going, you idiot, it's obvious.
And we would welcome those.
Yes.
Our next question is about Operation Dragoon, which is the 1944 landings in the south of France. Our questioner has asked, and this one's to you, Tom, how ultra intelligence was used in that operation, and is it true that Churchill didn't support it and so therefore blocked sharing ultra intelligence with the Allies?
Well, that's not true. Churchill didn't block the use of ultra. I'm not aware that he blocked the use of ultra anywhere, even though he was opposed to this operation. We know the commanders were receiving ultra because there were special liaison units, SLUs, set up in Corsica. There were two of them in Bastia and Ajaccio in Corsica, specifically to support the invasion. And Churchill was actually in Corsica at the time it took place in August 1944 to observe, and there was also a special SLU to keep him supplied with ultra while he was there. So we know there was ultra being sent to the area at the time. Now, the key point here is that Bletchley Park, contrary to what certain films might depict, it didn't pick and choose who to provide intelligence to. And it was never ordered to help some commanders and not others. The intelligence was shared on an equal basis with all British and American commanders at army level or above, so at the high levels of command at least. And the fundamental principle that Humphrey was working on was need, not interest. And part of that is you don't give people intelligence just because they want it. They have to need it for the operation they're conducting. But the flip side is, if they need the intelligence, they get it. A really fundamental principle that underpins what Humphrey's doing, because it means the customers know that they're not being left out of the picture. They know they can trust the intelligence. They're getting the full picture. And especially from the American point of view, the British aren't holding anything back. And that was always a concern. So politics didn't really come into it. They didn't allow it to come into it because they knew that any favouritism would undermine the authority of Bletchley Park and the trust of the customers. And where the Americans are concerned, you know, they had agreements. They had the Brucer Agreement, which laid down that they would share this intelligence. So Churchill couldn't just block the intelligence sharing without causing a major diplomatic incident. And the Americans would quite rightly say, well, you agreed. So the upshot of this is, provided the Allies with their collective command structures, with the combined chiefs of staff, had agreed to go ahead with an operation, Bletchley Park would support it equally with every other operation going on. The only limitation here, and it's relevant here, was sharing intelligence with the French, because the French didn't have these agreements with the British. Officially, they weren't in on the ultra secret. There were people in the French establishment who'd, of course, been involved in breaking Enigma early in the war. But by 1944, things had moved on a lot. There wasn't the same system for sharing intelligence with them. And actually, at some of the headquarters where they had French personnel on the staff, they weren't given an SLU. And the intelligence officers in that case had to go to the nearest purely British or American headquarters to get the intelligence, because they couldn't handle it in a place where there are French officers serving.
So this particular operation, our questioner said, how was ultra intelligence used? Is there something particular about Operation Dragoon in the use of ultra?
It's quite an interesting example, I think, because it shows how some of the political demands of the war trump the intelligence at times. So the plan for Dragoon is originally called Anvil, actually, the operation, and it's meant to go with Sledgehammer, which is the invasion of northern France, which becomes D-Day, Overlord. So you have Anvil in the south of France to pin the enemy in position and Sledgehammer to kind of deliver the killer blow. In the end, when Montgomery and Eisenhower go back to Britain and they do the detailed planning for D-Day in early 1944, they end up expanding the invasion. They go from 3 landing divisions to 5, and they add a couple more invasion beaches. And that means they need more landing craft, so they take the landing craft from the Mediterranean, so they can't launch Anvil along with Sledgehammer anymore. So Overlord goes ahead as a standalone operation with what's now rechristened Dragoon happening later on. And the big proponents of the operation are the Americans, and they want to support landings in Normandy still. They want to liberate the rest of France. They want to get the free French back on French soil, get French troops fighting in France, and liberate the country. Also, the Americans, they've never really been on board with the Italian campaign, which of course is a big drain of resources in the Mediterranean. If you're going to launch Dragoon, you need to take troops from Italy. And the Americans always thought that it was a bit of a waste of time. Churchill and the British were always the main figures behind Italy. So they're having this debate about how best to distract the Germans from what's happening in Normandy throughout June, July 1944. And ultra proves really useful in this debate because it shows what the Germans are thinking. And this is something Ralph Bennett talks about, as always, a fantastic analyst of Ultra who's read all of the messages. Ultra essentially proves the Germans are going to keep fighting in Italy. And so it's going to continue to serve as a way to distract German forces from the other fronts, from Normandy or the Eastern Front. There isn't any suggestion in Ultra that they're going to fight hard for the south of France. It's not a strategically valuable area, particularly for the Germans. You can't hold on to it if you've lost northern France. And they don't have the troops there to put up any serious resistance, and the Germans know that. So the signs from Ultra are, as soon as the Allies land, the Germans are just going to withdraw. You're not going to pin them in place and distract them in any meaningful way. So the Ultra really provides a very strong argument for the continued commitment of forces to Italy. But that's not what actually happens. Dragoon goes ahead. These forces are taken from Italy. They're launched into the south of France. The landings are fairly smooth. And as expected, the Germans retreat. In Italy, meanwhile, they launch an offensive at the end of 1944, Operation Olive, to try and break through the newest line of defences which the Germans have built, which is called the Gothic Line. And almost, but not quite, break through the Gothic Line. So Ralph Bennett says, if the forces that were now in the south of France had been in Italy, they might have been able to achieve a full breakthrough, capture northern Italy at the end of 1944, possibly being in Austria or the Balkans in that year or early in 1945. The strategic consequences for how the situation in Eastern Europe shapes out, because the Soviets get there first, are quite dramatic. But as I say, the political motivations of liberating France and getting French troops back on the continent, and also the fact the Americans are committing so many more troops than the British at this point, therefore they have the biggest say in the negotiations. That means, despite what the Ultra says, they do something different. But to go back to the original question, we talk a lot about D-Day because it's a particularly good example of Ultra being used, but it's not to say that D-Day was unique in the sense that they were using Ultra. They were using Ultra to support every campaign they possibly could. And Bletchley Park tried to give a complete and impartial service. But as we see with Dragoon, that didn't always mean that the intelligence was acted on maybe in the optimum way.
This reminds me, Tom, that Churchill was a big one for operational code names, and he's known to intervene to change the names of things. There is a military history legend, if you like, that Dragoon was called Dragoon because he felt that he'd been induced to do it against his will, that he'd been dragooned into it. But I've not seen any evidence of whether that's true or not. Is that something that came up in what you were looking at, or have you heard it before?
It's not something I've seen any evidence of.
Do we know when it goes from Anvil to Dragoon, or why there's the two? Is one American and one British? Or
well, Anvil gets dropped, I guess, when Sledgehammer's dropped, doesn't it? When Sledgehammer becomes Overlord.
Yeah, there was certainly meaning in those code names.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's called Dragoon, though.
Do we know if operations were randomly selected names, or did they often have names chosen for a specific reason? Or
the famous story, and it's a good pub quiz question, what is the linking theme between all of the British and Commonwealth beaches on D-Day? Because they are Gold, Juno and Sword. And the answer is that originally all three beaches were named after fish. And you had Goldfish, Swordfish and Jellyfish. But the story goes that Churchill intervened to say, I don't want any mother to receive a telegram saying her son died on Jelly Beach, because it just sounds ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So they changed Jelly to Juno for the Canadians.
I was not aware of this. You're right.
It's a good pub quiz trivia question. Yeah. But in the same vein, there is a story that Churchill renamed Operation Dragoon. Mm-hmm. Dragoon, because he felt he had been, to use the phrase, dragooned into it, and that it was done against his will. But he did have a reputation for striking out the names of things and going, let's call it something more interesting.
Yeah, and also Operation We Land on the Beach at Dawn doesn't really...
Does what it says on the tin.
That defeats the point of the code name.
Exactly.
Yes, it's always been a feature of British security versus American security that Americans quite often like to use code names that have some sort of connection to the operation.
Reveal exactly what they're doing.
Of course, so do the Germans.
Operation Iraqi Freedom isn't exactly giving much away.
The Germans have an enormous penchant for doing this, and Bletchley's often... They're intercepting code names, and then they're able to work out from the context what the operation probably is.
Nighttime attack in the desert.
Even when it's coincidental, for example, you have what's called WOTAN, don't you, which is the navigational beam system, which R.V. Jones deduces, because WOTAN is a one-eyed god, then it must use one beam.
Mm.
Well, that wasn't the reason the Germans came up with the code name, but it gave a really good clue, which turned out to be correct.
Fantastic.
To help the British work out what the system was.
And Barbarossa is the best example. Yeah,
absolutely.
I came across this just the work I've been doing on Tirpitz and Scharnhorst in the Arctic. You get the same thing. The Germans run two operations in late 1942. Operation Sicilian, which is actually sending U-boats to the Kara Sea, which is a fairly pointless undertaking in the first place. And Operation Citronella, which is the bombardment of Spitsbergen. And Bletchley Park struggles to figure out what these two operations are all about, because there's lots of messages from the Luftwaffe saying, we've got air cover for Operation Sicilian and it's in the Arctic, so it's clearly nothing to do with Sicily. They then come up with the operational code name for the operation that Scharnhorst is actually involved in. It's called Operation Ostfront, which, given that the Arctic convoys are supporting the Russians on the Eastern Front, calling it Ostfront gives a pretty good clue to what it's going to be about.
Sneaky.
And so exactly the same thing happens, that they choose a name that isn't as secure as they hope it might be.
They do end up getting slightly wise to this by the end of the war, though, because they, have, of course, have Operation Vactam Rhein, which is renamed from the original. I forget exactly what the original is, but this is the code name for the Ardennes counteroffensive, which is not a Vactam Rhein because they're not standing on the defensive, they're attacking. So they change the code name to make it sound more defensive and less aggressive.
And they also, well, there's limited radio traffic prior to that, is there? They change their operational procedure completely for that, don't they?
Yeah, this is, again, this probably isn't a code name that Bletchley Park even read, because the Germans are enforcing radio silence so successfully on that occasion. They're more worried about traitors on the inside than they are about Allied eavesdroppers.
Why this code name thing came up for me was, in my work on the Arctic, what Bletchley does very well is predicting when the German surface ships are going to leave the fjords and come out and do something. And this is relevant because if you've got a convoy sailing to Russia and the Scharnhorst or the Tirpitz come out of the fjord, you know pretty much what they're going to do. They're going to attack the convoy. So what the code name is for the operation doesn't really matter. But when they launch operations at points in time when there isn't a convoy to attack, Bletchley, although they know the fleet is doing something, they don't know what the something is, because in the absence of an obvious mission, they're very good at saying that the fleet is present or absent from the field, but what it's going to do once it's left, they really struggle with. So it shows the limitations of the intelligence in that sense. You've drifted quite a lot from Operation Dragoon, but there you go.
But interesting stuff, though, I think. And yeah, calling your operation the code name, which is the same as the mission objective, would be, you know, super helpful, I would say, to your enemies.
Well, I'd like us to move on to Operation Next Question.
Operation Next Question is one for David, which is, did Bletchley Park staff know when information that was acquired at Bletchley Park was successful, and did they even celebrate those successes?
Again, the answer to this one, I can give you the short answer and the long answer. The short answer is yes.
Fantastic.
The long answer is, inevitably, a lot of the time, and this is something we've talked about frequently in the podcast, the chain from, you know, Germans decide something, Bletchley reads some messages, you know, operation secret is revealed. It's never that straightforward. Often the products of Bletchley are much more long-term and much more general in their use. But there are specific occasions once in a while when a particular piece of intelligence that Bletchley generates leads to a recognisable and distinctive outcome. The one that a lot of our veterans will refer to is the sinking of the Bismarck. Ironically, the intelligence that was produced concerning Bismarck from Bletchley Park is a lot more oblique than people at first think. It's all to do with Luftwaffe commanders in Greece. And there's another podcast you can listen to about that if you dial back. But there were other maritime exploits where the intelligence led very directly to British successes at sea. And we have veteran accounts of how news of those events made its way back to Bletchley Park, and people did specifically celebrate.
Give us a for instance.
The famous, for instance, is the Battle of Matapan in March 1941. And this is where the Italian fleet, who have been quite cagey in their operations up to that point, launch an operation towards Crete in the hope of intercepting British supplies towards Crete. It's a rare use of Enigma by the Italians. The Italians have an Enigma system without a plugboard, so a simpler system than the Germans do, which they use a lot before the war and a little bit towards the beginning of the war. But in this case, one message on Italian Enigma was broken in Dilly Knox's section that were dealing that work, and it was worked on in particular by Mavis Beatty, and she talks about this in her book, how she broke this one message, and it basically gave Admiral Cunningham, who was Commander-in-Chief in the Mediterranean, several days' notice of the Italian sortie. And so he was able to get his ships to sea in advance and basically ambush the Italians when they turned up near Crete and sink several Italian ships. The consequence of this was that Cunningham, next time he was back in the UK, decided that he would come and meet the people at Bletchley Park who'd done the break. And Mavis Beatty describes how they were very excited. They were given advance warning that he was coming and that they went to the Eight Bells pub, which is just outside the then gates of the site.
Still standing,
the Still Eight Bells standing, now. Not completely unfamiliar to the recorders of this podcast. And so they went to the Eight Bells and bought some wine for the occasion. I will let Mavis tell you the story.
Normally, you see, one didn't ever know, and this is what we can't get people to understand, that if you're a codebreaker, you didn't necessarily know what the messages were saying, that once you broke one message for a day, that the setting which the operator was using would cover the rest of the day, and you just took it through to a machinist who ran it all off, so that you might break a message which said nothing to report, and you wouldn't know something later on, which was just what General so-and-so wanted or somebody else wanted, because we just didn't know, because that was not the way need-to-know worked. However, Matapam was different. The first message, a tiny message, said, today's the day -3, X -3. Oh, goodness, the Italians are going to do something. What is it they're going to do? And this was, of course, 3 days before Matapan, so that was the 25th of March, 41, and that was when we got the message. So then we heard what was going to happen on D-Day -2 the next day. We were up all night, of course, and then waiting for the next day, D-Day 1, and then D-Day. So everything had to get out to Cunningham in time. Well, of course, it was a marvellous battle, because it was at a very bleak time, March 1941. And, of course, traditionally, a naval victory is very good for the British public. And Churchill was over the moon, and he said that there was nothing like it, no fight since Trafalgar, and Cunningham was as good as Nelson, and so on. And then came the message through from the Admiralty at midnight, tell Dilly we have won a great victory in the Mediterranean, and it's all thanks to him and his girls.
But then Cunningham, of course, comes up and thanks you, doesn't
he? Cunningham, yes, Cunningham came himself a few months afterwards when he was on leave. And we, Admiral Godfrey brought him over, and we rushed down to the Eight Bells at the end of the road to get some drink, some wine. I'm sure it wasn't up to what the standard C&C Mediterranean was used to, but he also drank to us. So that, of course, imagine what that was like to a bunch of 19-year-olds. We were terribly pleased about that. We were in this little cottage, and the walls had just been whitewashed. Now, this will show you how sort of silly and young and giggly we were, but we thought it would be jolly nice if we could talk to Admiral Cunningham and to get him to lean against the wet whitewash and go away with a white stern. So that's what we did.
Is this a rarity? Is it the only occasion we've got on record of people understanding the impact of the work that they'd done?
Well, it seems to be a naval thing, because the other incident that I certainly know of, I mean, it may be just because I've done a lot of research on naval section, but the other incident that I'm aware of is Admiral Bruce Fraser, who later in the war was Commander-in-Chief Home Fleet up in Scapa Flow. And he was actually personally present on HMS Duke of York when the Scharnhorst was sunk on Boxing Day 1943. And that operation was significantly helped by Bletchley Park, by naval section being able to provide Fraser while he was at sea with the movements of the German ships and the fact that Scharnhorst had sailed from its hiding place in the fjord and they were able to ambush it. And subsequently, he came to Bletchley Park to, in the same way that Cunningham did, to sort of congratulate the backroom people. And we have several oral history accounts of this visit. Interestingly, we also have the Hut 11 visitor's book, and that contains Bruce Fraser's signature. I've said before in the podcast, I really like it when different threads of evidence all connect together like this.
Yeah.
We have these veterans talking about his visit, but he clearly visited the bits that had Wrens in them, because he went to Hut 11, where you had Wrens running bomb machines. He went to Block C, where Wrens were working on Hollerith. And
well, some Wrens. I some feel like Wrens I must say most staff in Block C were civilian.
Yes, the two ladies who described his visit are both civilian workers, but there were Wrens in the block as well. It may be a complete coincidence. He may have gone to other parts of the site that we don't know about, but he's certainly going to parts of the site that either directly contribute to naval intelligence or have some Wrens in them. We'll hear from the two ladies in Block C shortly, but to give you some background to this, one of the things we do know about Admiral Fraser was he was not only a great admiral, he was also a very nice man. A lot of the things you read about Fraser was he really had the personal touch and he came across very friendly and he had a way of talking to all ranks. And so this made him very popular, both inside and outside the fleet. The first person we're going to hear from is Peggy Munn, later Peggy Huntingdon, who was a civilian Hollow Earth operator in Block C. And she describes how in December 1943, the news was broken to her team that the Scharnhorst had been sunk. Peggy also described how a few weeks later she received what you might call even more personal thanks from Admiral Fraser.
And suddenly one day I heard a man's voice say, "Don't run." And I thought, that's not the boss. I mean, he never cares if I run or walk. And so I looked up and there was this group of sailors, three sailors with their smart hats on, you know, and smart uniform and a couple of medals and things, and a shorter, stockier man with loads of gold all over him. It didn't dawn on me until he came a bit nearer that this was an admiral, because 6 weeks before that, we heard in the night on December the 23rd, our boss came out and saying, "We've got some good news. We've sunk the Scharnhorst." Well, we'd all heard on the Pathé news at the cinema and everywhere about the Scharnhorst was Hitler's best, biggest battleship. And to think that, you know, we had sunk it, not we, but the British Navy had sunk it, was another cause for celebration, hugging each other and dancing up and down. And then we were told that he was going to come to Bletchley Park because he wanted to thank everybody at Bletchley Park for helping him sink the Scharnhorst. Well, you can't believe that we, doing this card system and what we were doing, could help to sink a battleship, could you? And so it was a bit amazing, really. It really helped us link what we were doing with the outside world, yeah, and the war effort. And he, 6 weeks later, he was going to come and thank people at Bletchley Park. Well, this was him arriving 6 weeks later, and he came to Block C. And he'd been up the end, and he stopped. But I hadn't seen him. I was too busy with my three machines. So when he got a bit nearer, he told me not to run. And so I switched the noisiest machine off and just stood there horrified, you know. And he came along and he put his arms around my shoulder and gave me a hug and said, "We've come to thank you all you girls and everybody, for helping us to sink the Scharnhorst. It was a wonderful thing for us, and we couldn't have done it without you." And he waved to all the girls. Some of them looked up and thought, "Well, who's he?" and took way back. But he gave me another big hug, and then he asked me what I was doing. Well, as I didn't know what I was doing, it was a bit difficult. And so I said, "Well, it would be it's rather complicated, and it might take a bit of a time, you know, a bit long time to tell him what it was all about." And he nodded wisely, like, you know, said, "Yes, I understand." And he was a lovely man, and gave me another hug around my shoulders and went on. And the two sailors sort of patted my shoulder a little bit when they went past. So that was my best memory of Bletchley Park, being cuddled by Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser, the Admiral of the fleet that sunk the Scharnhorst.
Rather to her chagrin, Peggy missed out on the other thing Admiral Fraser did when he visited, which was he gave a lecture in the mansion. Obviously, everybody couldn't fit in the mansion, so they had a ballot in Block C, a raffle, basically, to decide who could attend. And Peggy didn't get a ticket, so she missed out on the talk.
And then a message sort of came whizzing through the place that the Admiral's going to come in 6 weeks' time and give a talk on how Bletchley Park helped him do it. And so if you want to hear his lecture, put your name in the hat. So we found the hat and put our names in it, Jane and I, and the supervisor, who wasn't there at Christmas, at December the 23rd, and she didn't start working until the end of January. But guess whose name came out the hat? The blue supervisor, but not mine and not Jane. And I was up to cross, and I said to Jane, "Come on." So we went to the loo, and I said, "The supervisor's going." She said, "I'm not." I said, "No, neither am I." So I said, that's not fair, is it? She lives in Bletchley. She comes here on her bike. She lives with her mum and dad. I bet she never gives her any money out of her guinea. And I was raving on. And all of a sudden, one of the three doors opened and somebody flew out. And I said, who was that? She said, a supervisor. She never let on that it was her out there that she'd heard me. She didn't treat me any worse than she does before. But I don't care. I was right, wasn't I, to be annoyed. Not only jealous, but actually annoyed. Yeah. But of course, I never heard his talk, but I did get a cuddle.
Another veteran did attend the talk and gave us her account of it. And that is Joan Glover, later Joan Jocelyn, who we've heard from in this podcast before, who was also a Hollerith operator in Block C.
There was another episode where we had been working till late in the evening and suddenly the news came through that because of our efforts, they had located the Scharnhorst in the Norwegian field. And we thought no more about it. We were through to bits. I think we'd been involved in it. But a week later, Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser came to Bletchley Park and asked for the people that had been involved in deciphering the message be allowed to come to the, into the mansion and be told the full story. And so we trotted over, didn't we? And that was lovely. Mm. And he told us the whole story, which was sad, really, because it was a very hard-fought battle. Mm. The next morning in my billet where I was staying, the news came over the radio how wonderful that we captured the Scharnhorst and sunk it with the loss of so few men, which was entirely different to what Sir Bruce Fraser had told us. And that was marvellous, wasn't it? That was really interesting. So there were a few episodes like that which, you know, made you feel that you were really doing some good, you know.
Those are a couple of examples of where people were directly congratulated for the work they'd done. And we do know that as the war progressed, the compartmentalisation and the extreme secrecy that characterised a lot of the work of Bletchley did break down a little bit. And lectures and sort of pep talks of various kinds were organised. Tom, are you familiar with other ones cropping up? There were some in...
Yeah, it's something I wish I knew more about, but I've looked through the security files and there's quite a few letters going back and forth about inviting visitors to the park. So it's clear they were getting a lot of visitors. And the names you see include a lot of high-profile commanders, and not just naval commanders. You're right, David, this tends to be a naval thing because naval warfare is that much more decisive than air warfare or land warfare. But they're getting visitors all the time from these senior commanders. And you can only presume as they're walking around, part of that is for them to learn about what's happening here. And part of that is to pep up the right people, whether that's just the managers of the sections, but maybe occasionally they were giving similar lectures to the one Bruce Fraser gave directly to the staff. I think that must have taken place on quite a few occasions.
Do you know if staff from here were ever sort of bussed out for lectures or additional information or the bigger picture stuff?
There is the reverse in that when I was looking at coastal Y stations, some of the Wrens who work in the coastal Y stations are sent to Bletchley Park to see the other end of the operation, to see whether, because they're sending this stuff to Station X and they don't know what's happening to it or anything else. And they are brought to the site to be indoctrinated a little bit into how they fit into the machine so they can, partly for morale purposes, partly for operational reasons, so they can provide a better service. But certainly it's happening that way, that people from outstations... does that happen in other Y stations?
Yeah, they're bringing staff in from Bow Manor and from the major RAF stations as well. Bow Manor is the main Army Y station in the UK. They're definitely doing that. I don't know about Bletchley staff going out because this tends to be the hub and it tends to be this is where everything's coordinated from, so...
Yeah, they're not sent to the Admiralty or, like, round...
Of course, you've got managers going to the Y stations as well, but for operational reasons, not for morale reasons so much.
Mm. Yeah, there's some veterans' accounts. I can definitely think of a couple where Wrens are sent to the Admiralty, but it's, like you say, it's for operational reasons, not for any sort of lecture or...
background edifying information. It's absolutely brilliant that we've got these oral history interviews that give us this kind of tiny snapshot into Wrens being given a little bit more of a bigger picture.
But it must have been a feature of life that people would be doing their work every day and they would also be reading the newspaper every day. Mm. And you must have sat over your breakfast reading the paper going, oh, I wonder if that was something to do with that thing I saw last week. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have the opportunity to ask, but I'm sure it crossed people's minds.
And I think this must have been the experience in places like Hut Free working on the Army air material. It almost happened in reverse, even though they couldn't see the consequences of what they've been working on so clearly. We know they had busy periods. We know they knew when an important battle was happening and when intelligence had to be processed and out the door as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could read the paper the morning after and see what had happened at the fighting fronts, or maybe a few days later, and see the results that way. So there are different ways of working out what you're doing and how important it is.
So this slightly pervasive myth of people working in complete ignorance isn't necessarily the case. Whether it's very explicit information being given to them, like congratulations, or whether, as you say, it's the amount of work or the direction of the work that they've got in front of them.
At the end of the day, if you're doing intelligence work, you need to understand how the war is going so you can inform decisions that are being taken. So they need a certain amount of information, whether they're getting that through formal or informal channels.
And it depends on people's roles as well. I mean, the people who are working in, for example, in Hut 3 or in Naval Section, where they're more on the intelligence side, they're seeing stuff that makes sense to them in their daily work, which they can then relate to the newspaper. The contrast is, for example, with the bomb operators, whose work is completely meaningless to them.
Or Hollerith.
Or Hollerith work. And certainly in the bomb outstations, they do introduce lectures and other things just to try and give people a bit of a sense that they are contributing to the war effort, because they realise that people can't just be completely left in the dark.
But if we go back to the Y stations for a minute, I've been looking into the Y services, and what's really interesting is how important these big battleship battles are for people who aren't in naval interception, but for people who are working with the Army and the Air Force and in the civilian side of things, doing diplomatic traffic as well. It seems that when they were on the verge of sinking the Bismarck or sinking the Scharnhorst, they tried to get as many people listening to the airways for naval signals as possible. So they brought in manpower from outside the Naval Y Service, which is exactly what you'd expect them to do. And this seems to stick in people's heads. And so people who might have spent 95% of their war listening to something completely different, Japanese diplomatic or some Romanian police or something completely esoteric, will often mention that one day that they were listening in on German battleship communications and they think they made that contribution to sinking the Scharnhorst and the Bismarck. And it's not quite plausible, because you couldn't have this many people all making the decisive contribution. It's clear it's a massive team effort. There are thousands of people involved in these successes, of course. But it's interesting how they stick in the veterans' minds so clearly. And I think that reflects how they've been remembered in British popular culture and in popular memory of the war in the years afterwards, as well as how special they were in their wartime experiences.
Also, you have to remember that these incidents in the popular press were huge. Land victories are obviously reported and are greatly celebrated, and obviously the headlines on D-Day are massive, but probably the next tier down is when big German or Japanese ships get sunk. That, you know, it's a strong hook to hang news broadcasts and news information on. And it's striking how many veterans will remember those incidents. Even if the work they were doing, they don't know that their work connected to those incidents, they will say, oh, I remember being at work when, you know, Bismarck got sunk or whatever, because it just, they were such landmark events for the whole population.
So, Erica, I think we've got time for just one last question. We'll maybe not have this one as a plug for David's book, which is due out when?
December 2023.
Thank you.
Ideal for Christmas next year.
Yeah, I think we've had enough plugs for your book for next year. And let's hope that maybe it's not a plug for a book from Tom. But what do we have as our last question?
Well, this is a fun one, and hopefully you can't hear my tummy rumbling as I ask it, which is to both our historians, but let's start with Tom. What did the Codebreakers and the staff at Bletchley Park eat for their meals, and what did they drink?
I think actually at Bletchley Park they ate rather well, probably, on average.
Is that for wartime or in general, you think?
I think quite well in general, and especially well for wartime. But even, you know, generally in wartime, I don't think the food was as bad as the popular perception is. We think about rationing and we think people must have been almost on the verge of starvation. But the reality is Britain was never close to starving, even during the height of the Battle of the Atlantic. There was plenty of good food around. There just weren't the luxuries. You didn't have your sugar or as much tea as you might like, or, you know, eggs and things like that. So people obviously weren't eating steak every day. But what you see during wartime in the demographics is that people get healthier, especially people from deprived backgrounds, all of a sudden have an entitlement to a decent amount of good quality food. Life expectancy goes up. Across the country, rationing is not a bad thing for the population at large. Look at Bletchley Park specifically. Whether you like the food is probably a function of where you came from. we see opinions from both sides. A large portion of the staff, of course, they're educated. They're from quite privileged upbringings, perhaps quite sheltered backgrounds as well. If you're 18, 19-year-old Deb and you're used to being fed by the family chef and you come to Bletchley, you're going to find it a little bit of a shock.
Suddenly all that root veg in your life.
But other staff came from more modest backgrounds, and I think a lot of these people found the food adequate or, in fact, quite good. One of our veterans, Gwen Watkins, has actually dedicated an appendix of her book. Her book is called Cracking the Luftwaffe Codes. And she talks about the food because she'd read the novel Enigma by Robert Harris. And he has these descriptions about the protagonist eating things like whale meat and scraping the mould off pre-war jam. And it makes out the food was awful. But Watkins says actually the food was plentiful. It was well cooked. It was quite plain. It wasn't brilliant, but it had its upsides. There were things like salads in the Bletchley Park canteen that were basically unheard of. And that it was well-made food and healthy. Watkins also mentions the whale meat as well.
There was whale meat,
wasn't
there?
There was indeed whale meat on the menu. She says it wasn't that bad. It wasn't fishy or oily. It was actually, to quote her, since whales are mammals and don't feed on fish, it was of a thick texture like turbot, snowy white and rather tasteless and chewy.
Sounds disgusting.
So you wonder if it was that nice. I mean, maybe there are some rose-tinted glasses at play here slightly. We do have some other rather unappetising dishes mentioned by veterans like boiled heart. And lots of...
I think offal plays a large part, doesn't
it? Yeah, I think offal is mentioned. I don't know if...
Beetroot is mentioned quite a lot.
And well, I love a piece of beetroot.
Me too. I think that a few of the veterans that loved beetroot were thrilled with the sheer amount of it served here.
A lot of the problem people had with the food, though, was to do with the shift work. It was not the fact you're eating corned beef and potatoes, but you're having to eat it at 2 a.m. in the middle of a shift. Mm-hmm. That is something nobody ever gets used to in the middle of a night shift, I should say. And of course, you have variation of experience. People who are in uniform, if they're living in the military camps outside the gate or if they're living in the renneries, their food is kind of standard military level, which is not fantastic, but it is at least plentiful and healthy again. Those out in billets, they're meant to be fed by their billeters, because some billeters are really nice. And sometimes they arrange a fantastic spread and some of them are neglectful and they can't find any food at home to eat. As they fill up more and more billets in the Bletchley area, the number of good billets gets worse. They run out of good billets. They have to put staff in houses where they don't even have any cooking facilities, and they have to let them come into work to eat every meal in the canteen.
Because there was this big central Bletchley Park canteen churning out meals all the time, all throughout the day and night.
Absolutely. They have a big modern-style factory canteen. This is actually the first permanent building they build here. Before they build any of the brick office blocks, they build a canteen. Because they're having such trouble feeding something like 3,000 staff at that point in the mansion, it's just too many people.
But factory canteens, they come out of the First World War to a certain extent, don't they? But there was quite a lot of, I was going to say science, but professional interest in how you feed workforces on a large scale. And the Bletchley canteen is modelled on factory canteen examples. They kind of go and find best practice in industry, don't they?
Yeah, specifically, they went to the Kodak Photographic Works in Harrow and have a look at their canteen. And that was there until just a few years ago in use. Until they knocked the factory down.
Because we don't have much information about the Bletchley Park canteen. We don't have photographs of it during wartime, for example. We have some oral history about it, but is there formal documentation surviving about the menus that were served there? And
I don't think we've got any of the menus. One thing we do have in our collection is sort of Christmas menus, special occasions, in some of the sections into some of the peripheral sites of Bletchley Park. But as far as the canteen here goes, no, we don't have any menus. We do have some documentation about ordering ovens and big industrial mixers and things that they needed. So they were clearly, it was quite a mechanised operation in its own right, was the canteen.
But it's also, it's not a uniform experience, is it? As you were saying, the different services and the different people, because if you're in a civilian billet, you get your ration book. And the practice was they'd give their ration book to their billetor, who would then use it to buy supplementary food to feed them. But potentially that's only necessarily providing sort of breakfast and dinner, isn't it? They're able to eat at work. Supplementary to that. So they're actually getting their ration and extra food. The other thing about military ration isn't necessarily very interesting, but I did some work on our World War II army food years ago. And the contrast is the civilian ration is something like 1700 calories, 1800 calories a day. The military ration is between 3,000 and 4,000 calories a day.
So what it lacks in quality.
it makes up for in bulk.
Yeah.
And the simple fact is that if you feed active fighting soldiers or even soldiers in training on 1700 calories a day, they all fall over. Mm-hmm. So it has to be more generous. So if the military personnel are getting the military scale of ration, they're probably doing pretty well.
Even those that are working at a desk are still likely getting
them. But
if you look at Asa Briggs in that end of war photo, you can see he's quite well rationed even at that point.
But the problem is also the provision, because, you know, that sounds quite good on the one hand, but the Wren experience, on the other hand, was pretty dreadful, because we know from the plans of the site and the history of the construction that there was a special Wren canteen built. Can you remember when it was built, Tom?
I think it's towards the end, I think 44, I would say. It's over 44. Towards Block H, which was built in 44.
Yeah. The danger is, though, that you think, oh, the Wrens have got a canteen, that's great, they must have got nice food. Actually, the opposite is the case, because their canteen was literally a room with tables and chairs in it. It didn't have a kitchen. And the food was, by some veteran accounts, was cooked in the kitchens at Woburn. Mm. And then it was put in hay boxes, and it was put on the bus in the morning at the beginning of the shift that came to Bletchley with all the Wrens. And they would arrive with their lunch in a hay box, is as the title describes, you get a saucepan and you put it in a timber box and you fill the rest of the box with hay, and it theoretically keeps it tepid, like a hot box, but a rubbish one. And they were then served this six-hour-old tepid stew at lunchtime. So it was pretty grim. And although they had their own private canteen to eat it in, it was pretty horrible.
Not as glamorous as it sounds, is it?
Not as glamorous as it sounds. And it's also notable if you read the Wren accounts from the ones that weren't stationed at Bletchley, the ones that were stationed at Stanmore and Eastcote, for example, in London. They go out for food a lot. There's a couple of cafes at Cannon's Corner that are very popular.
Because needs must.
Yes, and I've got a quote here, actually, from Brenda Abrahams, who was born Brenda Pete. She says, "The food in wartime was never particularly plentiful or of good quality, but at Stanmore it seemed particularly bad. I remember specifically a concoction known as scented sausages, and I've never smelled anything like it before or since. They were absolutely ghastly. Grizzly stew was often served to us when we came off watch and before we went on watch, regardless of the hour, or whether or not we had just awoken from our off-shift sleep, and it was quite awful." So she didn't like the food.
But the other comment I was going to make, to go back to your class thing about the sort of which demographic people had come from, I have no concrete evidence for this, but I have my suspicions, and I think Erica might agree with me, that I went to boarding school, and boarding school food is not great, and it teaches you to eat more or less anything at more or less any time of day, because you spend your life starving. And some of the accounts, veteran accounts, the ones that went to boarding school go, oh yeah, the food is absolutely fine.
Everything was custard. It was marvellous.
Yes. Whereas the people who've been used to having home cooking their whole lives take a rather different approach. And so it may be that some of the posher girls, paradoxically, were used to rather rubbisher food.
But it all depends on your personal perspective. But yeah. I think we can say, to sum up, maybe the perception that people were on the edge of starvation and that Britain was going for a really serious food crisis in the war, broadly speaking, is a bit of a myth. Generally, people working at Bletchley and working everywhere else in the country did have access to enough food and enough good quality food. They just didn't have the luxuries.
And the whole ship runs on tea as well. Any number of accounts of tea being brought to people in their workplaces. They had tea ladies with trolleys who came round, because I think you've done some stuff on this. I mean, in the early days, people would go and get cups of tea, but then they found that it was wasting too much people's time.
Yeah, they did have tea urns here in certain places in the corridors, and we know where those were because they wrote it down. But it's at the Knockholt Y station. They have a particular problem with tea, because they have a canteen there, but it's about 10 minutes walk from the set room across some fields. And so you go on your tea break, and it's meant to be a 10-minute tea break, but it takes you 10 minutes to get there and 10 minutes to drink your tea and 10 minutes to get back again, so it's half an hour. And that takes hours and hours of man-hours of time every day that could be spent doing useful SIGINT. So eventually they clamped down on that.
In what way? They stop people from having tea breaks?
They put a tea urn in the set room.
Genius! Genius! I think we should all have tea urns in our offices, to be fair, to emulate that.
But to be
that
fair, this place does still run on tea, so...
Yeah, as do most workplaces in the UK. So.
And I think I should take this advantage to point out that Thomas's book will not be a Bletchley Park recipe book.
No, that will be my second book.
I'd buy it. While we're on the subject of food, obviously Christmas is approaching. Tom is actually sat here in a Santa hat as well, feeling thoroughly festive. Did they have Christmas?
Not just a Santa hat.
No, this is true. In addition to his usual historian attire, there is a Santa hat atop his head. Do we know if they had Christmas dinner at Bletchley Park or any of the outstations? Was that a thing?
Yes, that was definitely a thing, yeah. They always had a slap-up Christmas dinner, as you would expect.
Brilliant.
And sometimes it was really rather sumptuous, actually, as we know from the account of Phoebe Senyard. Phoebe Senyard was one of the long-standing members of Naval Section, working in this very building that we sit in today. So we thought we might leave off with her account of Christmas dinner at Bletchley Park.
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
in the role of Phoebe Senyard,
we present Erica Munro.
Phoebe Senyard wrote, By the time we went into the room where the luncheon was served, we were almost prepared for anything, but not for the wonderful sight which met our eyes. The tables were positively groaning with Christmas fare. They were arranged in a T shape. The horizontal table, which formed the top of the T, was loaded with turkey, geese, and chicken, whilst the table down the centre at which we all sat was decorated with a game pie and fruit salad, cheese, and various other dishes. Each person had a menu, which was afterwards signed by everyone there, and we set to and thoroughly enjoyed ourselves, and I know that I was still beaming at the end of the day and feeling exceedingly happy.
That's the end of another Top Secret Misinformation episode. We'll do another one definitely next year. We really enjoy doing these because it's a chance for all of the team to get together. Oh, well, not all of the team.
Thorough thanks and festive cheer should go to our wonderful voice contributors, Dr. Ben Thompson,
Sarah Langston and Owen Mugen.
Who can't be with us, but they're with us in spirit, at least. It's been a big year for the podcast this year. We reached our 10th birthday. So from all of us, to all of you, thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting us for so long. And look forward to next year's shows, because we're looking forward to them. We've got some crackers coming up. And they won't all be about David's new book, or will they? So from all of us, we wish all of you
Merry Christmas!
Wait a minute.
We've forgotten something.
Erica, what were the answers to those crossword questions?
Aha! I did give you two crossword clues from the original Bletchley Park associated crossword earlier. And for those listeners that have held on, let's give them the answers. There was a three-letter word, which was, we have nothing and are in debt. That is O, O-W-E. And the clue, which was an eight-letter word, the clue was scented, a bit like those scented sausages we heard about earlier. And the answer is not fragrant, as one of our historians has suggested, but the answer is aromatic. If you manage to get those, you're two clues on your way to becoming a Bletchley Park codebreaker.
I'm off for a sherry.
On that bombshell.
Is that it? Can we go home now?
And little tiny Tim didn't die.
God bless us everyone.
God bless us everyone.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.